This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Here are headlines from some of the stories we're following here today at NPR News. President-elect Barack Obama says he will set foreign policy, but added the best decisions are made with input from people with strong personalities and strong opinions. The president-elect made those comments after he named Hillary Clinton Secretary of State. Another tough day on Wall Street. At the moment, the Dow Jones Industrial Average down 539 points. And U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice urged Pakistan to cooperate fully with India in the investigation into last week's attacks in Mumbai that killed nearly 200 people. Pakistan denied allegations by India that it was linked to the carnage. You can hear details of those stories and, of course, much more later today on All Things Considered. Tomorrow at this time on Talk of the Nation, a dose of reassurance for those who think that text messaging will ruin the language as we know it. Relax, says linguist David Crystal. His new book is called Texting: The Great Debate. Yeah, he spelled that with AIDS. Yeah, join us tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. And here we go. While the world focuses on the fallout of the attacks in Mumbai last week and India's relations with Pakistan, Asra Nomani worries what this may mean for relations between Muslims and Hindus within India. Today she wrote an op-ed for the Los Angeles Times, Muslims, India's New Untouchables, where she argues the Indian government has overlooked its Muslim population. We'll talk with her in just a moment, but first we want to hear from our Indian listeners today. What is your view of the role Muslims play in Indian society? Give us a call, 800-989-8255, email us talk at NPR.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. Go to NPR.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Asra Nomani is the author of Standing Alone, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam, and a visiting scholar of journalism at Georgetown University. She joins us here today in Studio 3A. Nice to have you on the program again.
Thank you.
Now, Muslims comprise 11% of the population of India, obviously a minority, but still, that's 150 million people. India, people forget, the second largest number of Muslims of any country in the world.
That's right, just behind Indonesia, and more than the entire Muslim population in the Arab world.
So how do you describe them? Why do you describe them as India's new untouchables?
Well, I went back to India a couple years ago in 2007, and I woke up one morning at the Taj Hotel, which I write about in my opinion piece, and there the headline read about the statistics about the socioeconomic condition of Muslims. About 52% of the men who are Muslim were unemployed versus 47% of the caste that's called the Dalit class that's always been considered the untouchable. More Muslim women were unemployed than those that were from the Dalit class. So many of the Muslims had become uneducated over these decades since partition in 1947 when Pakistan was created. And so what I saw before me and then anecdotally in my travels through the country was that, in fact, the condition of Muslims had deteriorated so much that a depression had actually set in among so many people that I spoke with, from relatives to street vendors. Untouchable, you know, in India has always meant that you lived in other neighborhoods. You were literally people that were not to be touched because you were so beneath the rest of the society. And what I heard were, in fact, that Muslims had started living in ghettos because they felt they were safer in those communities. And one of my cousins told me about how he couldn't get housing because the Hindu landlord didn't want to have a Muslim in his building. And so from job issues to education, a divide had come to pass in India. And this has greatly saddened me as a child of that country.
Is this segregation by choice, as you suggest, for some degree of community and self-protection, or is this segregation by law?
It's not by law, but in fact, the Constitution of India protects the notion of people to have their rights based on their religion, their caste. But we all know that there is so much prejudice and discrimination, unfortunately, that's systematic in India. The way we've always known it is through the caste system. But the truth is that there's a great divide in job decisions, in employment, in housing, in education that plays out as systematic discrimination. And the report found that to be true. They found that, in fact, the percentage of Muslims from government to rail to national security offices had become so disproportionate to the population that they argued that there needed to be an equal opportunity commission, just like America had to deal with the great racial divide and prejudice that we've had.
You quote yourself in this piece that was published today as saying, India will explode if it does not address this problem.
I think that we know just very plainly that if people live in despair, they are more likely to go toward violence and toward fanaticism and radicalism. As a Muslim born in India, who believes firmly in the concept of India as a secular democracy, this is to me a tragedy, because from India is where we have prospered as a family. My father grew up in this city called Hyderabad that we've always known as Hyderabad Deccan, which means that it's in Hyderabad, India versus Hyderabad, Pakistan. This group called itself the Deccan Mujahideen. There's so much of a resonance of the past with when there was opportunity with this current day when there's just conflict and hostility that I only see trouble ahead if we don't deal honestly with this disparity.
Now let's get some callers in on the conversation. Again, we're talking with Asra Nomani about the op-ed piece that she published in the Los Angeles Times this morning. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. We want to hear from our Indian listeners about the role of Muslims in Indian society. Let's talk with Archana in Sacramento, California. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly.
Yes, you are. Thank you.
Go ahead, please.
I was just calling in to say I grew up in India. I spent 30 years there. I had classmates who were Indians. One of my bosses was a really nice Muslim lady. I you know, it's a little unusual when she says that the Muslims have done poorly. To begin with, the Muslims who were wealthier and better educated ended up moving to Pakistan. So the Muslims that started out at partition in India were the poorer, uneducated group of Muslims, and they tended to grow in a higher percentage population than the rest of the country. It stood out at less than 10% at independence, and Muslims now are more than 15% of the population. The people were among the lower classes who are having more children and not focusing on education and health. So it's, you know, when you talk about percentages, yes, they reflect a fewer percentage of people. But there are, well-educated Muslims. Azim Premji, who is one of the richest people in the world, not just in India, he's a Muslim. And India's president, APJ Abdul Kalam, Dr. Kalam, who just stepped down as president of India, one of the most respected people in the country, he's a Muslim. So to say that India is suppressing its Muslims, I don't quite agree. I see that the society has problems. You know, but it's just for everyone. It's an overpopulated country. There is a lot of communalism, which is not just among Hindus or Muslims. You know, my family is a Jat family in northern India, and I know how the clique thing works. It's just an extremely stratified society. So it's not against Muslims. It's just a very unusual society. It's not open like the West.
Just to remind listeners, the partition of which she spoke occurred in 1947. British India divided into East and West Pakistan, as well as India itself. And, of course, many Muslims did go to what was then East and West Pakistan. Of course, there were hundreds of thousands died in the violence at that time. But Asra Nomani, is she right? The better educated, the wealthier Muslims left the country?
There is a disparity. I mean, my family is just a perfect example. We had a choice, like all Muslim families, and my father's side left in the 1960s for Pakistan. They were educated and they were middle class. My mother's side stayed, and it's in that community that I see the anecdotes and hear the stories of the experience over time. We have, you know, the examples that she talks about, which are completely true about the richest man in India and the president, but for the most part, we don't have a pattern of this kind of success in the country. And the thing that I think we really need to do is take responsibility for the way that we can lift those people that are left there and bring them up to a place that is at least at par with others in the country. I mean, Muslims in India absolutely do not have a monopoly on poverty. The real tragedy of India and this economic boom is this disparity that hits all of the population. But the report that I talk about and other incidents of this inequity bear out that in education, in health care, in issues of employment, there is systematic discrimination. And I think we would be better served if we're honest about that instead of simply looking at statistics that we're going to be inclined to leaving the poor behind at partition.
I'm not talking about leaving anybody behind, but I'm saying that it's not that the Muslims are being, you know,
singled out is what you're saying.
As a country, yes. Well, it's, you know, the Muslims themselves, there was this case 2 years ago when a Muslim woman was raped by her father-in-law. She complained, and the Muslim court decided to take on instead of the real court. There are all these parallel Muslim courts that will prevent the state government from, or the federal government from doing anything. The Muslim court, the Sharia court, actually said that she is her father-in-law's property and that she should treat her husband as her son. She was a mother of 4 children at that point. She was like a 20-something-year-old young girl.
Trust me, as somebody who completely challenges so much of the traditional interpretations of Islam, I think one of our greatest enemies in India is are the clerics and the leaders who are not serving Muslims also. This Muslim personal law board that made that ruling of which she speaks has been focused on protecting traditionalism and rigidity in Islamic interpretation. And unfortunately, they have an audience then in people who feel disenfranchised. And so in villages and in communities all across India, sadly, there are very conservative mosques springing up that have a home in the people who do feel disenfranchised. And sadly, rulings like that one actually take root.
Archana, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
Our guest is Asra Nomani, the author of Standing Alone, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And an email question now from Sudha in Phoenix. While I'm not denying the fact that we have to deal with the discrimination of the Muslim Indians, I'm baffled as to whether your guest condones the violence that just occurred in Mumbai because of the existing social problems. We have had Indian presidents that are Muslims, entrepreneurs, etc., and simply blaming the social ills for the poor conditions of the Muslims is not an appropriate response.
Yeah, you know, some of the emails that I've received today have thought that looking at the problem that Indian Muslims are facing is in somehow not accepting the wrong that happened here. And I think, you know, I would be on some other planet if I didn't condemn what had happened. I mean, absolutely. The militancy and the root of the crime that happened here is unacceptable. But what I find really fascinating by that kind of response and the response of other readers is I don't think a lot of people want to deal with this issue. I think that, you know, it's really easy to just look at the militancy as a crime and an unacceptable problem. It is. I mean, it absolutely is. But it's been really difficult for our nation, I think, in India, to accept some of our own culpability in abandoning our own citizens. And that includes the Muslims, that includes so many. And this is what I'm simply asking, is that we recognize that we have a hugely important population that's living in despair, and we need to do something about it if we don't want this cycle of violence to continue.
You write that people, Muslims in India, members of your family, are now afraid of a backlash, even though from what little we know and what indications we have, which are certainly not definitive, these attackers came from outside the country.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that always happens, whether you go from India to Pakistan or from Pakistan to India, is that there's suspicion associated with you. you. I've had relatives who have gone to visit their family in Pakistan who were then accused of being agents for Pakistan. And the same happened to me when I went to Pakistan. I was accused of being an agent for India. Sadly, I think that these are two countries where we are juvenile in our relations with each other. We have not had wise, mature leadership that's dealt with the geopolitical issues. Asif Zardari today, in the leader of Pakistan, blames non-state actors without taking responsibility for the root of the militancy from which this act of violence came. India has not dealt with the issue of Kashmir in its borders in a way that actually allows this to be removed as an excuse for militancy from Pakistan. And so what I realize has happened is that people, ordinary people, then are left as pawns in this battle.
Another thing you point out is that Americans, for whom India is a growing partner, a strategic partner, military partner, business partner of increasing importance, continue to regard India as a thriving secular democracy. And you say that the plight of 150 million Muslims in India puts the lie to that.
I totally believe that the idea that India is a model secular democracy is a myth. I wish it to be true. I believe in India. I love India. I believe in all of the principles on which it was born and on which it exists. But the truth is that the way that so many of the Muslims and so many of the poor are treated in that country is not testimony to a thriving secular democracy. And we are failing so many citizens there. It is completely abhorrent and criminal the way so many people in that country live. And I think, as Americans in this age of globalization and booming economies and call centers over there, turn a blind eye to this fact. You know, I talk about how I reached out to former Defense Secretary William Cohen to talk about an op-ed he had written about how great a partner India is. And when I wanted to talk about these issues about the Muslim minority, his publicist said these issues were too much in the weeds for him to discuss. Well, the weeds are what we need to pull out, I think, in this world if we want to actually make existence a better situation.
Asra Nomani, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Asra Nomani, the author of Standing Alone, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam, a visiting scholar of journalism at Georgetown University. Her op-ed appeared today in the Los Angeles Times. She joined us here in Studio 3A. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.